a tendency to acknowledge the right of indigenous peoples to the things Sheldon was talking about, self-government, land, and the point that Oren made. Does it reveal, as a matter of principle, the right of native peoples to subsistence, acknowledging that that is a right that inheres in their condition, their status as native people? And that's, I think, something that we should allow to emerge from what Doug and Sandy and Clem have to say to us and to Mr. Hsu a little later. So forgive me, I don't want us to start talking about what the Supreme Court of Alaska did 2 weeks ago, and because we've all been kind of wrestling with that judgment, and indeed the judges obviously did a certain amount of wrestling with it. I don't know who won, but that is in the wrestling match. Raina, you wanted to say something. There's a mic there, if you wouldn't mind.
This is something of a continuation of Nietzschmann's earlier remarks and Sheldon's and Rosita's, and referring back to Bishop DeRue yesterday. And it is very much on the topic of the place of indigenous peoples in the world, though I am less interested, I must confess, and this is a part of what I want to say, in what law says or does not say. And I think we always have to keep in mind that the law is someone else's, you know. And if we need to raise the questions about indigenous peoples and the place of indigenous peoples in this world, one of the issues we must raise is whether the law is relevant at all or irrelevant, and how we could make it relevant or how we could make it irrelevant. As long as we continue to fret about what the law does, we are operating in someone else's arena. And this is part of a continuation of my earlier remarks yesterday. When we raise the issue of children, for example, being taken from native people, we may be raising an issue that is perfectly within the rights of the law to raise. The law protects the taking of native children from their parents. The law protects the taking of native children from the extended family.
The law encourages it. It
protects them. In fact, in the Indian Child Welfare Acts, the Mormon Church in specific got the one exemption because it saw itself not only as part of the law, but in fact, above and beyond it. Well, that's a whole other matter, but I say these things to open an arena of questioning that really gets beyond what the law does and what the law does not do, and raises some philosophical questions about the place of indigenous peoples in this world. As long as we, and this is very much what Sheldon was talking about, as long as we collaborate with systems which have been engineered to make us something other than native, we are then in an arena which will never allow us to raise questions again. It all becomes a game. And native people know this. They presented with one model after another in which a treasure has been held out to us. I was telling Barney and Sandy last night, you know, here's Christianity, take that. That will save you. Here, Indian, take education. This will save you. But what happens when you become educated is that they tell you then you're no longer Indian. I cited an example of an institution which said they couldn't hire Indians because Indians didn't have the kinds of credentials they wanted. And I said, well, but what about so-and-so and so-and-so, naming a whole list of people who had those credentials. Well, they're not really Indian anymore, you see. As long as we play in those games and one more lure is held out to catch our particular fish, we are trapped. We're trapped because it's always a snare and an illusion, to use biblical language for something that is biblically unspeakable. So I think we have to ask ourselves as well, what other options are there? One of the things I've begun to think about, and I was again saying this last night to some people, as we keep talking, one of the things that seems to be the most frightening, the most unspeakable, rather than patching up a flawed system, and we can patch up ANCSA, you know, we can patch up the Constitution, we can keep making amendments to it, you know, we can patch it all up, we can allow Indians in under the Civil Rights Act, you know, say, here, you really are an individual just like everybody else. That way lies, you know, another kind of trap. One of the things I think we have to raise is, what is it about us that is so frightening? When we stop talking about folk festivals and we stop talking about ethnic food and we stop talking about restaurants and we stop talking about culture as art and we start talking about culture as resistance, culture as land, culture as self-determination, culture as nationhood, it becomes frightening, because to talk of that is to talk of isolation. To talk of that is to talk of separatism. To talk of that is to talk about difference. And that is the thing that is the most frightening about us and raising those issues. You know, and it doesn't matter left or right. They've all got a system that we can come in under. You know, liberals call it integration. You know, rightists call it assimilation. Doesn't make much difference. When we start calling it self-determination, that's the frightening thing. When we start talking about, to raise the issue that seemed to be so lively yesterday, we start talking about museums that are defined in our terms, education that is defined in our terms. To talk of that is to talk of separatism and isolation and an identity that exists beyond someone else's identity, that exists beyond the Constitution. What is the Constitution to us? It is nothing. It is nothing except something that holds a door open and a pit looms beyond. The abyss yawns for us when we walk in that door. So that's what's frightening about us. And I think we have to come to terms with why that's frightening and why we must press on and ask what we would be if there were no Constitution, if there were no schools as they know them, as we know them. What would we do to preserve that which we think is remarkable, and in which ways would we preserve it? Culture, I don't want to think that culture is simply resistance, in the same way that I don't want to think that culture is simply a culture of poverty, which is how our culture often gets mistaken. But we have to begin talking about ways of seeing ourselves that exist apart. I'm not talking about another kind of illusion, which is separatism in the old sense, that is, that we don't go to schools, that we don't get educated, that we don't ride snowmobiles. You know, salvation does not come in people saying, give up your technology. Technology is not our enemy. It is the uses to which it is put, and I think we have to all know that very clearly. So we cannot talk about separatism as a kind of pragmatic construct, but as a philosophical one. What would it mean to construct and reconstruct a world in which we know how to do what we have to do in the natural universe, in which we know how to teach our children, in which we know how to preserve our culture? I'm not talking about a world in which we will not make mistakes, but a world in which we determine our own freedom to make mistakes. So all I'm simply suggesting, following up on discussions yesterday and today, is that there must be a philosophical discussion, not only resting in what other new and different systems are doing once again to redefine us, but in insisting that we must have that philosophical discussion about how we define ourselves. Once again, it keeps cropping up. And it will continue to crop up, and it will have different names. But we can't avoid that discussion.
A young woman in Seattle at the hearing that we held there last weekend, Raina, I can't remember her name because there were many people who spoke, but she was a Tlingit. She is a Tlingit. And she said that she referred to the willingness of people to buy and appreciate Tlingit art And she said the white people are willing to embrace our art, but they won't embrace us.
You see, we are just another commodity. And as long as we allow ourselves to become just another commodity, then you can consign culture to the folk festival. We can be clink it, you know, once a year. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, I think this is worth pursuing before we move on. And we have Henry Hsu and Oscar and Robert Goldwyn and Verna.
This is really just a very quick footnote. I agree very much with the general spirit of what Raina Green just said, and I'd be the last person to argue against raising the deeper philosophical questions and challenging the actual existing laws. But I do think there's a third level that comes in between the what we might call natural rights or moral rights that would be part of the philosophical discussion and the particular domestic laws that we might want to challenge. And that is the whole body of international human rights law. And in a way, this is just a defense of what we're going to do later. I don't think that we should forget that there has been this attempt to embody in the international human rights law some of the deeper moral requirements. And international human rights law has all kinds of limitations, but it does have some strengths, and I think it's one of the things available to use. So that I certainly agree that the fact that an existing state has passed a certain law is not the end of the story, and we may want to raise philosophical questions about it. I also think we may, in some cases, be able to appeal to the body of international law, which international law about human rights, which is an attempt to rise above particular national.
Yeah, well, I think that's a connection that Henry has usefully made, but we'll continue with this and move our Nietzschman, Sanders, Davis group a little back to the back burner just for the moment. Oscar Coagley, you wanted to go next, I think? Did I? Oh, Robert Goldwyn, go ahead.
Yes. Sorry. To follow up on Raina Green's point, I think she has brought a problem into clear focus. It's been clear for the last few days that we've been talking about two different worlds and what the relationship is of those two different worlds. I've had some quarrel with the way the non-native world has been depicted, but I don't see much point in belaboring that now. The significant thing is that the native peoples present a very different problem to the general principles of the United States as expressed in its great documents such as the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The very simply, the principles of equality and liberty and justice, all starting from the rights of the individual, express themselves in an effort to let every individual and every group share fully in the life of the society, so that there is a powerful integrating, assimilating, absorbing flow constantly out of the, as a result of these principles. And the idea of justice is to bring everyone in, not to exclude. And not only is there that drawing force, but there's also a demand from almost all groups that they be let in. Now, this special problem, of course, with the native peoples is that the impulse is exactly in the opposite direction. And so what is ordinarily thought of as justice with regard to all other groups is manifest injustice and, in fact, cruelty, as described here. So the difficulty is in trying to make an adjustment in what is otherwise considered the American way to rectify the behavior and to try to find out what would be sensible, fair, and appropriate with people who, for very good reasons, want something almost exactly the opposite of what all other groups seem to want as part of the society of the United States. As I understand Raina Green's argument, and I have no way of judging how representative her view is, but others of you can judge it better. As to the two worlds, she says we want one and we don't want the other. As much separation as is possible and makes sense, that separation is what we want. And so it would be not the educational system that everybody else is trying to get into, but an exemption from that educational system and an educational system of our own. Not the economic system that everybody else is insisting on getting into and getting their fair share of, but our own economic system, and then work out the relationships of our educational system to yours, and our economic system to yours, and our political system to yours. It seems to me it's a difficult task, but I don't see why it's impossible. The first step is the kind of thing that's being done now, a clear explanation of why what seems just to everybody else is a severe injustice in this case. I think the case can be made persuasively. I think when it's carried too far and is strident and develops into a political harangue, I think that's counterproductive. But that's just my outsider's opinion, and one thing I'm learning here is not to tell other people how to do what they do. But it would be helpful if someone could begin describing and carry it beyond just a brief statement that we need an educational program. To give some idea of what the native education would be, so that we could begin to see how it might be developed, how those who have some say in it too, education officials of the state and of the United States, and whose agreement or cooperation might be needed just to let go of the control they have, for them to begin to see that it might be consistent with what they think their responsibilities are to say, all right, do it your way. But there'd have to be some, if we carry the description of it far enough, we might begin to see what the exceptions have to be, what the difficulties would be, what kinds of compromises and cooperation would be required. But I would, as I see it, the whole thing is really possible because it follows a principle that most Americans adhere to, at least in words, and is very old and conservative, laissez-faire, which means let them do what they want. So if your idea is a laissez-faire program for Native Alaskans, once we could see what the implications are, what the consequences are, what the principles are, It seems to me that there are real possibilities of accomplishing it, starting from a clear explanation, as has been developing here, that there are really two worlds, and what looks like justice in dealing with all other kinds of groups is really very different. See, most Americans would be appalled at the notion that what efforts at educating Indian children can be compared to what the Soviets are doing with Afghan children. And it is a wild exaggeration until you make clear the difference of the two worlds. Once that is made clear, then something of the analogy begins to be persuasive. Once the analogy is persuasive, I think most Americans will say, let me hear how we can rectify this. Well, I'm finished. Yes, I'm finished. Go ahead.
I just want to make three
Raina and then Verna.
Very simple corrections. One, I don't presume to say what Alaskan natives should want or need. I'm just raising some questions. I mean, there is no presumption on my part about that. Two, God forbid it should ever get out that I came out for laissez-faire. I'd cut my throat. And the I know you're being provocative. There is certainly some resemblance to that. Let's just get the record clear. Yeah, I want us to be let alone. I don't want us to let you alone. That's the difference, and there is a real difference. And three, most Americans might be horrified at being compared to the Soviet Union, but if the shoe fits, and they do mean to do what the Soviets do, I will never believe that they don't mean to do just that. It would be foolishness to assume that 250 years of history tells us otherwise. They do mean to do precisely that. Otherwise, the whole body of law and history would be a different body of law and a different history. Don't think for one minute that Americans don't mean to do that. Americans in the lower 48 right now who want to get in my bed certainly want me in their schools and want to change my mind. So it would be a total snare and illusion to think that they don't want to do that
well,
to us.
Raina, just for the record, I think you are completely wrong, and I think it's very harmful that you have that opinion.
Well, we disagree.
Yes. All right. I want it to be clear that we do.
Yeah. Verna Kirkness?
It's always very difficult to have other people understand what it is we mean when we talk about education and the kinds of things that the formal system of European education has done to us. In an attempt to maybe clarify that, perhaps I could talk a little about my life, about going to school. I'm from an Indian reserve in Canada, and I started school there in the 40s. And when I went to school there in the 40s, one of the first things that we encountered is not being able to speak your language. And you've heard that time and time again, and you're sick of hearing it, but that was very, very detrimental to us. It told us right away that something that is near and dear to our heart was not right, and that English was the only right way to the only right language to speak. So that was one thing. And when, like, our families weren't respected, we were told, you know, you see the Canada food rules and the kinds of things you're supposed to eat, and eating the kinds of things we weren't eating was wrong, like bannock and, you know, things like that from our own culture. I mean, these are the kinds of teachers we had. We didn't learn the history of our own people. We heard, in fact, negative history about our people. We heard about the savages. Even I was afraid of the Mohawks for a long time, you know? No kidding. I should have been, she says. But you know, you hear all about these things. We weren't told that these great rivers and, you know, places that were discovered, we were told that the people from other countries came and discovered these. They didn't tell us that the Indian people showed them where these rivers and lakes were and that they simply put their names on them. You know, again, the same old idea. This goes on and on in our history. In our lives, you know, not learning anything at all of our own background. And in fact, everything, most things about our own way of life was wrong. I remember those days when, those were the days when my father was a fisherman. And we used to go out and work. This is what we're calling subsistence, I suppose, although he was a commercial fisherman, but in our way, that was a way of making a living. And the whole family used to go out with my father to the fishing grounds. And we learned how to fish. We learned. I knew how. I can make the nets, or I can't even think of the terminology now. That's what education has done to me. But I could make nets. I could clean fish. I could do all these things, you know, that was expected in a subsistence kind of economy. And then the government passed a law, brought in family allowance, and said that we couldn't go out to the lake anymore. So ourselves and my brothers and so on that should have learned that way of life, we're not able to learn that same way of life, you know. And so these are the kinds of things that we've been exposed to over the years. And even my mother could tell worse stories. My uncle tells some really good stories about the kinds of teachers they had in their old days. You know, the veterans in Canada had first choice for jobs after they came back. And that wasn't Indian veterans as much as others. So you got all kinds of people teaching our people out on the reserves. We had people there. My uncle said that for one whole year, all he did was march. They had a shell-shocked teacher that came back from the war, and he was there, and they marched and marched, and he said, you know, that was really quite fun. He said, but you know, the girls never could march. Now, you know, but it's things like that, the kinds of teachers we have had, the kinds of, the lack of attaching honor to our way of life, our customs, our culture, our people's contributions to the Canadian development of Canadian society. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the education system. It's a brainwashing system. And as Sheldon was saying, you know, the people that become educated become very suspect. People say, okay, you're not Indian anymore, you know, because of that. Well, it's true. It's very... There's two sides to that. One, I think it speaks to the fact that many of our people don't complete school. We have a large number of dropout in all over Canada and all over the other places. We hear that all the time. And that is because they're resisting. It's really a resistance of the education system in order to preserve themselves for who they are. And I think that is one of the reasons we're saying that we have to do something to ensure that the education system is a meaningful system to our own people and acknowledges our own way of life. But the other side of the coin tells me this, and that is that those of us, some people that do get through in the education system, I think we do because our identity is intact. And I really think that that is one part of it, because I know who I am. I was fortunate to have a grandfather that lived to be 104 years old, who made damn sure I knew who I was. And I think that carried me. That carried me through. And I could take what I wanted from this other system, and I could manage to get through. And I have clearly in my mind, you know, who we are and so on. So that is another way to look at it. So that's what we have to do for all our children. That is what we have to do for all our children. They have to have a sense of who they are. We can't have the destructive forces of the schools and the churches doing what they did over the years. You know, one interesting thing that happened, I was a teacher and for a number of years, and I remember one time, you know, you can't do this. I was teaching history, and, you know, I woke up while I was teaching that history lesson. I don't mean I was really physically asleep. I woke up and I was teaching this crap, this nonsense, you know, and I suddenly realized, you know, this is not right at all. This isn't the history of Canada. This isn't the history of our people. And so I went completely the other way. and I started talking about real people, our lives. And I said to the students, these were grade 7 students, I said, write me an essay. I said, about Canada, I hate to tell the year, it says 1965, I think, without white man. You know, write a story about that. You know, a lot of times they say, oh, Indians don't like to write. They hate writing because it's in English and all that. These kids wrote pages and pages and pages. They really enjoyed the topic of 1965, Canada, 1965, without white man. And their portrayal, you know, essentially was, if they were able to carry on, they did have some idea of the way it was, you know, and people say we romanticize when we talk about the past a lot, but they saw it as their own development, and they saw it in a way that they would be productive and happy people today, and they saw themselves as really unhappy with the kinds of restrictions and barriers in this kind of life. I think that's what we're talking about. You know, I often think We had our own way of life for so long, which was totally interrupted for many centuries, interrupted by schools, by church, by laws, by settlement, by everything. I often wonder, where would we be today? Where would we be today if we didn't, you know, if we weren't fortunate to be discovered? You know, where would we be today? I think that's the part we're talking about, that interruption. You know, people say to me when I suggest that we would be far better off today, that our cultures would have evolved, that we might have even discovered the wheel, invented the wheel, I mean. You know, they always say, oh, Indians, yeah, they're not too bad, but they, you know, they never had the wheel when we got here, you know. Big deal. Yeah. So I think we would have done that too. I think there are a lot of things, because when you talk about Indian culture, it's always that culture, that way that we lived, our people lived years ago. I mean, our culture evolves the same way as everyone else. Even Professor Henke in his statement said something about he wondered about his own culture of because he didn't like rock music and television. You know, and I thought, to myself, now that I've gotten to know him, I'm sure he liked rock music because he seems quite lively to me. No, I may have misunderstood that, but sometimes people say, okay, with you're losing your culture, you know, you're losing your culture. Well, how the heck can you lose something when it's dynamic and it evolves and it includes some things of yours? Like one time someone said to me, oh yeah, you have TVs and washing machines and all that, you know, you wouldn't have that today. I said, yes, okay, you have canoes and snowshoes and that. I said, does that make you an Indian? You know, I mean, that's the same thing. You can reverse this. Anyway, I'm rambling on here. I think there's a lot, there is that problem. Oh yes, also they say if you talk about this, they say, oh, if we didn't come along, you all would have died off. You know, because you were dying off, and you know, with various things, and yet we do know. I mean, history tells us that the diseases that were brought and the kinds of things that went on caused the mortality rate to be so high of our people all over the years. I'm sure, again, survival of the fittest. We would have lived through all of that. I know that's like talking, you know, after the fact. I mean, this is today. We cannot do that. But what we're trying to find here, all of us, is what do we do now? You know, and it's so hard. I think to me the greatest block is this understanding. We can't seem to say anything without understanding. We seem to have such a hard time to be on the same wavelength in anything we try to describe. In Canada, we've really moved along to have Indian control of Indian education because we really believe that we have to design our own form of education if we're going to survive as a people. We can't continue to have these kinds of values inculcated into the curriculum and into the learning of our people today. We have to turn that around. And in a in a statement, we can just say that we have to, within that system, tie what we're learning with our own economy. And I think that's what people have been trying to say. The way we want to live in the 21st century, and we're not talking about a long time ago again, today, how we're going to live today. We need to be able to do that within our school system. So our school system has to address the needs of our people and has to attach this kind of honor or whatever you want to call it. We have to do something with our culture, our own way of life. We talk about learning styles too, and that's very real. We have certain ways with our learning styles that are based on our values. I heard someone say, I think it was Bishop Remy DeRue, that said values are lasting. That's what it is with us too. Our values are lasting, and our values can fit into this century too. There are many things, there are many ways to achieve the same end. And I don't want any, I feel that our aim also is to be able to have our people educated in every sense, just like everyone else, doctors, lawyers, merchants, chiefs, in every way. I think that we want to do that, but I think we can achieve that far better by addressing the system of education. We have to have a system based on our own philosophy. I just want to make one more point, and that, if I've made any points at all, one thing I wanted to say too is, one of the greatest tragedies, I think, of all time, and that really have posed the greatest difficulty that all of this emanates from, and that is the way the churches or the belief of the people that came here, that we didn't have a religion, that we didn't have a power greater than ourselves, that made us not recognize the Great Spirit, and all of that. And that was central to many, many of the indigenous people of the world, and everyone has been subjected to this same kind of change, bringing in Christianity and not allowing the people their own way of worship, which was central to the life of the people. I was thinking yesterday when the bishop was talking that, that was one of the things I was really wondering about. First of all, the people that, disrupted our lives, of course, came here for the sake of economy. And then the missionaries came. And when the missionaries came, they really made change people so much. And I wondered, what are the churches doing to address this issue? I think we had very good words from the bishop yesterday, but when you come right down to practicalities, what is the church doing now to reflect maybe a new thinking, to support the kinds of things that the bishop himself was saying in recognition of Indian people and Indian rights? And, and also, what are they doing for the parishioners? What are they doing for the other people to help them to understand what it is, why we have to fight for what we want today? What are the issues, and why are the issues what they are? Anyway, I get so frustrated, and sometimes it's hard. I always listen to my friend here to my left, and I find that he's so articulate and clear in presenting what he wants to say. And I just get so, riled up and frustrated and in my feelings that sometimes it just gushes out. But I do hope, my hope is, and I believe that there is a way that we can understand each other, and I think people have to really, in fact, we have to do it ourselves. We've got to take hold of this and do things the way that we know is right, and I know that the ways are there, the directions are there, and we want to do these.
Thank you, Verna, very much. David Case and Josephine Bigler, excuse me, and Gard, I was wondering if you wanted to get in on this particular fight. I'll be willing to call. You moved up there closer to a mic, but maybe we could hear from David. And
I just want to say that I don't know that this point will get made. I've done a little teaching, and I think that the thing that frustrates me about the a lot of what you were saying is that not only are these matters not taught to Native American people, they're not taught to non-Native American people. And It seems to me that that is something that is crucial, perhaps in Alaska, because maybe it seems to be more doable in Alaska than in the United States. But it is important, I think, that the schools should expose non-Native American people to at least the fact that there is a great difference between these, what I think are, it's, you have to stereotype it and simplify it to say it, but are two ways of, of life that are quite different. And at least we ought to get out of the out of high school knowing that. That way, when the issue comes up for a vote to the people in an election, that then there you will at least have what Thomas Jefferson thought you ought to have, an educated, informed electorate. Otherwise, you've just got cannons rolling around on the deck.
And Josephine Bigler, and then Gard.
I guess I want to address what I heard from Verna over there. Perhaps, you know, some people are wondering what I'm doing here, and people have asked me, you know, about my work, and I come as a representative of the Methodist Church, United Methodist Church. I work for Global Ministries, which is the United Methodist Church, and my particular portfolio is ethnic and language ministry. I have two other colleagues, one's Asian, the other's Hispanic, so we work with the ethnic minority people. And that was, the ethnic minorities were mentioned a day or so ago. And the ethnic minority of the local church, and when we say ethnic minorities, in my work, it refers to the Asians, Hispanic, Black, and Native American. And I am responsible for the Native American portfolio. I relate to the Indian Methodism, which spreads out across the lower 48, and the ethnic minority local church emphasis is the number one priority of the United Methodist Church. It has been for 8 years, and it is going into this new quadrennium of 85 through 88. And I have to tell you, the ethnic minority people were responsible for carrying it into this new quadrennium, because people did not expect it. And the one large agency that carries this or decides or thought it was deciding the priority, people didn't expect it to be the next the priority again. But the ethnic people got together and they had to work at this a year prior to 1984, when we have our general conference every 4 years. But the people strategized, and they were able to carry through a third quadrennium, which is unprecedented. So in National Division, we have the ethnic minority local church emphasis, and I carry the Native American, and I also carry what we call the North Central jurisdiction, which is, you know, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio. Those states are included. So I work with all the ethnics in that North Central region. And we not only do funding. Now, this ethnic minority local church priority has so many million dollars assigned for the quadrennium. And the National Division, to which I am attached, we can only, our monies go toward salary support of the ethnic pastors and what we call outreach ministry. The outreach could be, you know, your food and clothing, your various kinds of programs which are outreach. And then there's also the capital, which another department on the same floor carries, a remodeling and the building of churches and the some of you call a manse or the parsonage, the house that the pastor and his family lives in. Okay, those are the monies that go toward helping the Native people. But some our Native people have not really come through with proposals. We find other caucuses are, you know, really much more active in getting proposals to us. But it's not only the ethnic minority local church, but we have other funding. And this, we have to work with the Methodist women, we call the United Methodist Women, and they usually have two other types of funding. And when, and these are also non-Methodist groups that can apply. But when it's United Methodist Women's proposals, they look at the women who are involved, the percentage, 50% or more, and they look at ethnic women particularly. Are ethnic women involved? Are what kind of board are they involved in the planning? And when I say ethnic minority local church, I say EMLC, we look at the percentage of ethnics involved. Who sits on the board? Youth, women, and the older people. And if they were involved in the planning and the monitoring that will be done. So it's not only funding, but we also help in advocacy, in building networks, referring to other ecumenical agencies within our building, or we help facilitate programs. And of course, the number one need among all of our ethnics, Native people, is leadership development. And so it's a constant effort to work on leadership development. And so we find people who will try to find people and fund people to go to seminars, workshops, and we have one, some of you who live in the Washington area know IMPACT, which is brings people from all over the U.S. to hear the congressional Congress people present their legislation and the issues that we hear about. And we find people from the different four ethnic groups that we send to the IMPACT that's coming up the last part of this month. And we do have a couple of Native people, Methodists, and I'm sure there are Presbyterians, Lutherans, others will send Native people from their groups to Washington for the IMPACT meeting. And we also, when we get proposals, we look to see if these are people, how many Native people, where they are, what their